Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Alan Levy Show at blogtalkradio.com. Be prepared to call in now and chat with Alan and his very special guest right here at blogtalkradio.com. With no more further ado, please welcome your host, Mr. Alan Levy.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Alan Levy Show on Blog Talk Radio. It's a pleasure to be here today, and we have a very special show which has just been organized in the last couple hours. Congressman Duncan Hunter will be joining me today. He's calling in from South Carolina, and he just threw his hat into the presidential race, the 08, a Republican from California. So he'll be joining us in probably around 15 minutes or so. So I want to thank you for joining me today. You're listening to this broadcast live now, if you are, on blogtalkradio.com/Alan Levy. And if you're listening to this broadcast archive, you'll be able to listen to a number of places, and that this broadcast will be available a little later this afternoon for your listening pleasure.
Duncan Hunter here.
Congressman Hunter, how are you? This is Alan Levy on Blog Talk Radio with Amy Domestico.
Hey, Alan, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today and
be
on Blog Talk Radio. It must be a very exhilarating day for you.
It's been an exhilarating couple of days here. Yeah, we announced in Spartanburg, and had a great announcement. Lots of folks turned out, and then we campaigned with the entire family with a motorhome and lots of squealing grandkids down the line to Columbia, and then to Charleston, and then on up to Myrtle Beach today. So it's been great.
That's excellent. And you're in Myrtle Beach now. You're on the way to the golf course.
Well, actually, we're heading the other direction right now, but we're going to try to get over there shortly.
Good
and
to you.
And we just finished there was a Republican meeting here this morning, and then we had a lot of went to a Red Hat convention, which is the Red Hat Ladies.
Okay.
Which was 500 very energetic ladies with red hats on. And it's a kind of a unique association, and we managed to crash the party there and talk to folks. It was a wonderful time. I was with Lois Ergel, who's a local leader, wonderful lady, and she was a featured speaker. So she managed to get us in the door, and we had a great time. Met a lot of voters.
Well, that's excellent. Happy to hear that. And I wanted to, since we have you on the phone, and I wanted to get right into it, and I know, you know, we all know that you announced that you're running for president, and you're from San Diego, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And why don't I just, I mean, for our listeners, you know, very interested to know why, you know, what compelled you to get into the race right now?
Well, you know, I've been in the House for 26 years, focusing on national security, but always working other issues as well. And this was I've always wanted to serve all the American people and to have a chance to lead this nation. And I think that now in this new era of terrorism and with an emerging China, which is stepping into the superpower shoes being left by the Soviet Union, and North Korea now having some nuclear devices and Iran pursuing them, that national security is going to be the major focus for this country for the next 5 to 10 years. And that's an area where I have focused my career's efforts. And I think I can be some value added to the country. So we're going to get out and let the American people know that I think we can have a new sunrise of opportunity and faith and freedom in this country, and I want to be the next president. And I think, you know, I think we've got a chance this year. This is a time when you have an open race where you have no heir apparent in the vice presidency.
Right.
And where you truly have lots of people have a shot to win this thing. I think I've got a good chance, and I think that my focus on a secure border, and I think securing the border is a national security issue, not simply an immigration issue. A secure border, a strong national defense, and I also stand for something that's different from most Republicans. That is, I think we've made terrible trade deals with the rest of the world where we've given them built-in advantages on taxes and tariffs that give them points on the scoreboard before the opening kickoff in this world competitive game that we know that is known as trade. That's put a lot of our businesses and workers out of business and out of jobs. And I look at them. I look at trade deals like arms control deals. The only guy who can make them is the president and the administration. An individual businessman can't go and negotiate with the government of China for a trade deal, just as he can't negotiate with China or Russia for an arms control deal. So
right.
That's an area where I want to show some leadership.
Now, what you know, the Republicans have, of course, have been in charge, right, for the last 8 years, and so as part of Congress and with a majority control Congress. You know, where do you think the current administration strayed, you know, with regard to border control and or this trade issue?
Well, first, we actually passed. We built the border fence when the Republicans came into Congress, and I wrote the border fence provisions that we passed in 1994 to build a double fence in San Diego. And by doing that, we took a no-man's land that was where armed gangs roamed at night, and most of the illegal aliens and most of the narcotics that came into this country were smuggled. And we turned that into an orderly border where we cut down more than 90% of the smuggling of people and narcotics. So we did that. This year, we managed to pass this bill, which the provisions for the fence I wrote, that move the San Diego border fence, that build it and extend it 854 miles across Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. We did that in the last of this, just the last session before the election. We got it through. The president signed it. So I would say that the administration wasn't enthusiastic about this. I was hoping they would be. They weren't, but in the end, the president did sign that bill. So on with respect to border control, we have a lot of work to do. The good news is we've actually got the fence in the law. We simply have to push this huge bureaucracy called Homeland Security and make them do it. Now, on trade, both all administrations in the last 15 years have been unabashedly free trade. And the problem is that trade is a business deal between two countries. We've been making bad deals. I wish the guys who do our arms negotiations were doing the trade deals, because they wouldn't let the other countries get away with murder. Right now, China can subsidize its exporters 17%. It can penalize our importers 17%, and it's now devaluing its currency 40%. That means that in the world marketplace, their products look a lot more attractive than ours, and that's why I challenge you to go to a major store today and try to find something that's not made in China. It's so bad that financial advisors around this country are walking into businesses and boardrooms and saying, even if you have a great labor efficiency ratio, and even if you are highly productive and highly tooled, I advise you to go to China with your jobs and make your stuff in China, ship it back to the U.S. You'll be treated better from a tax and tariff standpoint than if you make it here in the U.S. And that's killing our industry, and it's hurting jobs. And I, as president, would do the same thing that you do when you got a bad arms control deal. You make a new one.
Let me just go back to the first issue of the border control. What do you do? You know, the issue, I understand, and I guess you're targeting illegal aliens, drug smuggling, and obviously a lot of that's going on the southern border there. But what do you do about the north, you know, the Canadian border? I mean, do you think it's feasible to build fences, of course, you know, to the full north? And what about, one last thing, is about allocating additional capital to the borders by the ocean side, you know, where we can easily be infiltrated, and we probably are. I mean, in other words, do you really think that the border down in the south is going to be the answer to these problems?
Yes, I do believe it is. And the answer to your question with respect to Canada is I've held hearings in Canada with the Armed Services Committee over the last year on border security. And Canada has we have a fairly efficient mechanism on the Canadian border. We do have people that come in illegally, but not a tremendous number, because it's more difficult to come into Canada from other parts of the world. For example, last year we caught 155,000 people coming across from Mexico who were not citizens of Mexico. They came from virtually every country in the world. That means there probably 500,000 came in And they came, those are people who are not Mexican citizens, but they came from almost every country in the world. And of the ones we caught, 1,100 of them came from communist China. Some came from Iran, some from North Korea. So the message is that a smuggler who takes $1,000 to move a person who wants to come across simply as an illegal alien, or takes $1,000 from a guy who wants to move cocaine across, would happily take the same $1,000 from a terrorist to move him across. So with respect to Canada, Canada at this point, the flow out of Canada is not a threat from the briefings and analysis we've gotten. But what you do as a nation is you do what is necessary to secure your country. And just as we've done inconvenient things at the airports to secure our country, you have to have a border. And I think the message of 9/11 is you have to know who's coming into this country and what are they bringing with them. And with respect to the maritime borders, you have to do essentially the same thing. You need to bolster up your Coast Guard capability. But I would say it's much more difficult for a smuggler to move large numbers of people across a maritime border where he's got to go up, he's got to get boats, he's got to get out on the high seas, then he has to infiltrate and land. And that's a much more difficult undertaking than simply driving people in vans to the border and, when it gets dark, send them across into Arizona.
Right, okay, fair enough. Now, you know, the term Reagan Republican is used quite often, and I know, you know, I'm 47, so I know, you know, was around when Reagan was here, and, you know,
I came in with him in 1980. He was a young guy then. He looked younger than I did.
And, you know, social media is very big now, and a lot of the people that will be listening to this broadcast are in a demographic that you may not normally get necessarily. And I'm very pleased, by the way, that you're on Blog Talk Radio, and we'd love to, you know, educate you more and your team on what this is. But the term Reagan Republican, you consider yourself a Reagan Republican, but this doctrine of peace through strength, what is your view on the Iraq situation, on the president's handling of Iraq, and where do you stand there?
Well, first, you know, what we've done throughout the world over the years is that we have had basically a three-step program in trying to bring freedom to other parts of the world. And the first step is you stand up a free government. And we've done that in Iraq, but of course we did that in Japan after World War II. We did that in the Philippines. We did that in Salvador in our own hemisphere. So you stand up a free government. Number two, you stand up a military capable of protecting that free government. And number three, the Americans leave. And we've used that basic pattern to bring freedom to literally to hundreds of millions of people. And with respect to peace through strength, I was here in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan was facing the Russians, who were very aggressive at the time. They were moving SS-20 missiles into Europe and ringing our allies in Germany and France with those SS-20 missiles. And Ronald Reagan started to move out Pershing 2 missiles and ground-launched cruise missiles to face off against the Russians. And the liberals in this country went crazy. They said, you're going to start World War III. I had one gentleman in Iowa point out that his local newspaper wrote an editorial saying better red than dead, saying they were sure that Ronald Reagan was going to cause a Holocaust. At one point, the Russians picked up the telephone and called the president, and they said, can we talk? And they did that because he stood up to them, because he achieved peace through strength. And when we started talking, we didn't just make a deal with the Russians to let them have their part of the world. We started to dissemble the Soviet Empire. And as a result of that, you've got troops from Poland today, which once was behind the Iron Curtain, now standing side by side with our people in Iraq. And similarly, I was here when we went down to El Salvador, when Russia was destabilizing El Salvador with arms shipments, and the FMLN and communists were assassinating anybody who stepped up to form part of a government. We provided a little shield around El Salvador. We helped them have their first democratic elections. And today they are a fragile democracy, and they've got troops in Iraq helping us. So it's in the American interest to spread freedom. That's first. I think that's one of Ronald Reagan's trademarks. And I think that's one most Americans would agree with. It's in our interest to have a Japan on the other end of the Pacific Ocean as a democratic country with a good economy and with some clout it's in our interest to have a free Germany today. That's why we did the Berlin airlift, when people said, why are you going to all this trouble to try to just keep this little spark of freedom alive in Berlin? It cost us a lot of money. The Russians pushed us heavy, but we did it. It's why we had the Marshall Plan and fought for the soul of Europe after World War II. So we have gone to enormous efforts to establish free governments around the world. Now, if you take all that to Iraq, it's in our interest to have a free country in that part of the world. And if we can have a country in Iraq that is a that has a modicum of freedom, that is a friend, not an enemy of the United States, and that will not be a state sponsor of terrorism, then that it will be something that accrues to the benefit of our country for a long time. And I can tell you, I've got as a father who's had his son, who was a U.S. Marine, go to Iraq twice. In fact, my son joined the Marine Corps after 9/11. Did two tours in Iraq, the last in Fallujah. It's a dangerous place, and it's and we have anytime we have Americans in combat and you have casualties, every casualty is a tragedy for our country. So I think it's a rough, difficult proposition, but we're standing up the military in Iraq. We're on the second step of this three-step process, and I think that the Iraq government will hold. A car bomb is not
an alternative. Do you think they're doing enough, the Maliki government?
No. And my recommendation to the president is I've identified 27 battalions in quiet areas of Iraq in the nine provinces that have almost no fighting taking place. And I've recommended to the president that they rotate those guys, those 27 battalions, into the fight. Get all the Iraqis into the fight. They have 129 battalions total. The Baghdad plan is to stand up an Iraqi brigade in each of nine separate sectors in that city with two battalions of Iraqi soldiers with an American battalion behind them, backing them up and helping them logistically and mentoring them. And my recommendation to the president is to rotate in every single Iraqi battalion, get them all combat experience, because that's what matures a military force, is getting them into real operations. And after we stand up the Iraqi forces, we leave. And at that point, the Iraqi government will have the level of violence that it's willing to politically tolerate.
Right. I mean, the issue of Islamic fundamentalism, of course, is broader than just what we see in Iraq, right?
And certainly.
You know, and that's an issue that we've never dealt before. I mean, you've talked about, you know, Reagan dealing with Russia and in the Cold War and the Berlin, but we've never had this type of an enemy of freedom that willing to kill themselves. And how would you deal with that type of enemy?
We actually had that type of enemy. They were guys who did suicide bombers. Were kamikazes. We did see those in World War II, and it astounded us when we saw that first wave of aircraft come in and fly into our warships. So we have faced that before. They were called kamikazes, but this is different. I agree with you that this is every one of these challenges is different, and this is fundamentally different. And there's not going to be any surrender on the battleship Missouri in this war against terrorists.
Right.
And it's going to be tough. As the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, I've worked to add more Marine personnel, more Army personnel, but more importantly, we've beefed up special operations, which is a key to fighting terrorism, and also intelligence operations.
I was just going to say that, intelligence and, don't you think we really had to restructure the way we gather intelligence, right?
Yeah, but you know something? It's always some of the old, some of the new. You know, when we invaded Iraq and we had lots of high-end weapon systems, precision systems, and smart bombs, we still also had heavy armor that was mighty nice when you had RPGs coming in. And with respect to intelligence, there's no substitute for having a guy in the room who's one of your agents or one of your contacts when they make the decision, when the terrorists sit in a room and make a plan to hurt Americans, to have a terrorist act. There's no substitute for having somebody in that room who can tell you about it and you can take the necessary action. We have almost no penetration of that part of the world with our intelligence apparatus. And that's been a real problem. And what we really had, and from my perspective, and this isn't something that I've never heard any experts comment on this, but this is my instincts on this. We came out of World War II with an intelligence apparatus that was directed toward Europe, toward Germany, toward Italy. We had a little bit on Japan, but not too much. Now we have we need an intelligence apparatus, and that intelligence apparatus that had that direction, that was European heavy, has persisted for this this post World War II era, because we then went into the Cold War with the Russians, and it took on had a European dimension and an Eastern European dimension, but it didn't have a Middle East dimension. As a result of that, we have an intelligence apparatus that evolved for a different part of the world, and you have big pieces of the Middle East where we have no penetration, and that has been that's accrued to our detriment. And you probably saw this in Iraq. I think you had lots of people. Some guy from Iraq who goes to the bars in London as an expatriate and tells about how he's got. How much political power he's got in Iraq, and how he can bring this group or that group in. A lot of those people, I think, puffed up their own importance, and I think a lot of our folks gave more credibility to them than they should have been given. But in terms of real penetration in the country, where we had people in that part of the world. Who in the right positions were at a deficit, and that's been a problem in the Middle East. And of course, with respect to terrorist groups, you've got some groups that where it's almost impossible to penetrate the groups.
Yes, well, I understand, and I'm hoping hopeful that any new administration, of course, is going to have to change the way they do things and the way they gather intelligence. And I live. 15 miles from the World Trade Center, and so everyone has felt that. I just came from London. I was there with the British Council, and the UK has been a big supporter of the United States, of course, but there's a lot of wavering that's going on. The other things, it's a little disconcerting in terms of Western Europe and how they're supporting initiatives. And I don't necessarily mean the war in Iraq, but the war against this Islamic fundamental ideal that has to be addressed, of course. But let's move. Can we just move on to another topic?
Oh, absolutely. Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, great. So I'm reading the release, and you're obviously quote unquote Reagan Republican. You're on the right, and I see that your objective, you would appoint anti-abortion judges to the federal bench, my question is this: do you feel like we're kind of things are moving closer to the center? Given this last election, or do you feel like you can really run in a polarized manner either way, either right or left? What's your sense?
I think you got to have your principles, and my principles are pro-life. But I'll tell you one thing I noticed about Ronald Reagan when I ran in 1980 when he ran for president. It was a great time. A lot of people who didn't share his principles on life supported him, because I think they looked at him and they said, "So this guy sees is a little more sensitive to human life than my own perspective," and I don't hold that against him, and I still like him, and I'm going to support him. It was interesting to see that Ronald Reagan not only convinced a lot of people that there's value in unborn babies. But I think that a lot of people who otherwise would have had hardened positions against him didn't, because they could see that he was genuine in his belief. And I think Americans respect folks that are genuine in their beliefs.
So, no, and I respect that. And he was, of course, a great communicator, right? I mean, he was...
I'll tell you, he was... And you know something? He was totally genuine. I mean, I went to see the president after he was out of office and in L.A., and didn't have any reason to have to run for any votes or do anything, and I brought my staff up to meet him. He told each one of them a little story that related to them, And I thought as we walked out that door, what a great person. Under no obligation to see the public or meet with them, and nothing to be gained by it. And he made the day of each of these people that he talked to.
Right.
That's a great person.
Now, you were announced in South Carolina, and I believe John Kerry announced in South Carolina.
You got me. I was announcing yesterday on our show. I said, and I'm the first person in history. And the announcer pointed, he said, you see that ship over there? He said, that's the carrier that, I think that's the Yorktown, right? He said, that's the carrier that Kerry stood in front of when he announced, well, okay, first Republican.
Okay, fine. You're flexible. You can move on the run.
You got to win South Carolina if you want to win the nomination. I don't think anybody's won the Republican nomination without winning South Carolina. But plus, it's an important place because this was a big piece of what I call the arsenal of democracy that made billions of yards of cloth in World War II and made billions or made 100,000 tanks and 41,000 artillery pieces. And our industrial base helped carry us through World War I, World War II, and the Cold War. And we're sending a big piece of that arsenal of democracy offshore now. You can see some of it in China now. You see some of it in France and some of it in Germany. And I'm worried that as the Armed Services Chairman, I sent a team down to get to try to find high hard steel 2 years ago when we realized we had to up-armor our Humvees, these Humvee vehicles, so the roadside bombs wouldn't hurt our guys. And I found one company in America that still made armor grade steel, and then we had the company in Switzerland cut off this important component, the crystal component to our JDAM bombs, our smart bombs. We had one company in America left that still made those, thank God. And so we see the arsenal of democracy being pulled apart by this policy called free trade. I'm not a free trade Republican. I think trade is a deal. It's a business deal between nations, and you got to make a good deal just like you make a good arms control deal. We've made a terrible deal, and secondly, we haven't been verifying, as Ronald Reagan said, trust but verify. The Chinese are cheating on the deal. They're taking hundreds of billions of dollars from us each year in an unfair way. That puts our guys out of business. And beyond that, they're buying military hardware with American trade dollars that we may one day face on the battlefield. So don't put me down as a free trader, and that is one place where I have a strong divergence with the entire membership of the balance of the Republican.
Well, I was going to ask you that question next, and I wanted to – well, first, I mean, just as an – I know you were a Vietnam veteran, and Kerry was as well, and, you know, there was obviously a lot of these issues came up as a result of, you know, his time in Vietnam. And do you feel like you'll have to deal with some of these similar type issues? I mean, not with those specifics, but when people start rehashing things that occurred in the 60s, I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, listen, I think it's good to have I think it helps you if you're running for president if you got military experience. I didn't do anything special in Vietnam. I was a very average GI. And you got guys that were running. I think we can all classify John McCain as a genuine hero in Vietnam. But I tell you, I've got a great son who, as I said, joined the Marines after 9/11 and did two tours in Iraq. And he is a hero. And I think the American people like the idea that we've all got something. If you're going to be involved in making foreign policy, you've got something in this game. You've got some stake. And I think that is, I think in that sense, the military service is beneficial.
Right. Now, you had indicated that, you know, you talked about the other candidates. And, you know, this campaign for both sides can theoretically cost $1 billion. I mean, $500 million for each candidate. I don't know. I mean, you're laughing at those numbers, but that's what I heard.
Now, are you trying to ruin my day?
No. I just wanted to know. Yeah. I mean, in terms of your strategy, you know.
Well, let me tell you what I'm doing. I'm my strategy is real simple. First, I don't need any image consultants, and up to date, I make my own commercials and I write my own speeches. When you do a lot of stuff, you need to have people. You're going to need to have supportive staff. But I don't need the consultant crew that a lot of folks have hired. And I had a big kickoff here in South Carolina on Thursday without having a single hired staff person in South Carolina. And I had 300 people turn out, and great, great people, and volunteering and helping. I think if you're right on the issues, and my issues are strong national defense, build the border fence, which I authored in San Diego, and build it across Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, bring back high-paying jobs with a good trade deal in place of the bad one we've got now, that resonates with people. And if you got a good message, then you can the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, and my straight line is right straight to the viewers and the listeners in this country. And so I am going to need money for radio and television, but I don't need a bunch of handlers, and I don't need a bunch of consultants. In fact, one of our hometown papers wrote this story about here was Hunter out traveling by himself, speaking to groups and doing commercials and interviews and things. And they wrote that as if that was a drawback. That's actually an advantage. It saves you a lot of money. So I don't need the $1 billion. But I do want to approach Romney for a short loan until the Iowa caucuses.
Yeah, I'm sure. Now, the important question is, do you use a lob wedge or a sand wedge?
I use a sand wedge. 56 degrees.
You do use the 56.
Yeah.
Well, you know.
What a lob wedge is, the most dangerous club in golf because it's got just a thin angle on it that it's really easy to hit it about 2 feet.
Well, I use that 60-degree occasionally. It has got me at a certain problem, so I just want to know that you're well-armed when you're down there in Myrtle
Beach.
Actually,
I don't have anything right now. I mean, we're gonna have to rent some clubs here. Hey, but listen, on the money thing, we did raise in the last day. I just want you to know, in the 24 hours since I announced, we've raised $300,000 mm-hmm. from all over the country. So people are coming in, and they're calling in, and that's pledges. They're calling and saying, hey, we're sending checks in for such and such, and we write them down and get their names. But we've raised $300,000 in 24 hours, and that ain't bad.
No, that's not bad. And I think that it's comforting to know that it would be nice that people with good ideas, it would be nice that you can get through this process without having to have $100 million. And so on, and it remains to be seen. Each and every year in a campaign, it seems like it gets more expensive. But adopting certain of these tools, like Blog Talk Radio, where we have an opportunity to speak for 20 minutes or so on issues and let you get into them, is a good platform for candidates.
Yeah, you know, it used to take a lot of money to move messages, and today messages can be moved because of what you're doing with efficiently and effectively and without much expense.
Right, exactly.
So get the message out. If you got the right message, you got a good chance of winning without having to spend it too much or shine it too much.
Right.
So that's my plan, go straight at the American people, and we'll see if I can't draw a crowd.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining me on Blog Talk Radio. We have this archive. I mean, the way Blog Talk Radio works, it's streamed live over the web, and it's archived. And this platform could be used for town hall meetings where you can invite people to call in with questions or so on, and then those broadcasts are then archived, and you can actually distribute them and send them around. So I appreciate you joining us today. I know we caught you on a busy day, and I want to thank you for participating, and it was very enlightening, and I wish you the best of luck.
Well, thanks so much. Really, really appreciate it, and we'll see you down the road.
Very good. Thanks, Duncan.
Okay.
All right. Have a good day.
Yeah,
that was Duncan Hunter, and he is he's in. He's running for president of the United States, and he is very focused on his idea. I think he really has a clear understanding of how he wants to at least differentiate himself from the rest of the candidates. And look, it's not an easy job to do this, and he obviously has a great deal of care about what you know where he sees the country going. And look, you have to give him credit, and he's taking that position and moving on. So thank you for joining me today on Blog Talk Radio. It's the Alan Levy Show. We'll speak to you soon. Have a good day.